And welcome, welcome all to meeting number 3 of the Public Safety Committee. Clerk, can you please take the roll?
Yes, Legislator Green. All right, Legislator Todaro. I see you. All right, Legislator Gilmore.
Here.
Chair Johnson.
Here.
Legislator Myers. I see you in there. And Chair Baskin, present as ex officio member. All members present.
Hey, Legislator Todaro, I did see the clock. I was trying to get it under the 30 seconds. Thank you, sir.
You beat the clock. You're all good. I thought I'd have a little fun this morning.
Right, yeah. Doesn't hurt. All right, so what we'll do is we'll go through our agenda and we'll return back to our discussion. We only have one actionable item on agenda, but we'll go through it and we'll turn back to the to discussion after our actionable item. So items 1 through 4 will remain on the table under my authority as chair. Page 2 of the agenda. Items 5 will be tabled under my authority as chair. Item 6 will be received and filed. Item 7 will be tabled under my authority as chair, which is our discussion item, but we'll return to that after our actionable item. Item 8 we'll come back to. Items 9 and 10 will be tabled under my authority as chair. Okay. On to our actionable item. Communication 5E-11. Commissioner Nevers, the floor is yours.
Well, good morning, everyone. I come before the legislature this morning. We are seeking permission to dispose of a couple of pieces of equipment here as far as county responsibility and liability and transfer them to our partners at Cattaraugus County as well as Orleans County. And additionally, an older trailer of ours that we want to pass down to the Sardinia Fire Company.
Okay. On the question.
I just have one question.
Legislator Green, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Before we looked outside, did you offer these, like, what was the process for, like, the command vehicles?
So just to explain, the command vehicles that we have here are vehicles that have a tremendous value to some of the smaller counties that we mentioned here that don't have the wherewithal to purchase them. We maintain 2 of these vehicles here, state of the art. They are utilized by all of the agencies and are used at many of the events around the county. So as opposed to just pushing this around the county, we have that capability. We've certainly never surpassed the ability based on our resources. And it does have to meet a criteria with the Department of Homeland Security for still continuing that mission. So for example, if a town such as Amherst or Hamburg recently did a transition where they're updating their communication center, we have the mobile command facilities that can go out and can assist them so that they could move their dispatchers in there. So we maintained our capability. We maintain our working relationship with all of the agencies, towns, villages, and cities within Erie County. We're passing these pieces of equipment on down so that more of our regional partners can benefit from them, and it remains a regional asset in the event that we would need to bring them back into Erie County.
Yeah, what I was kind of looking at is just what the general process was. Was it like the command vehicles were offered to Erie County municipalities first, and then we expanded out? Like, I just try to understand the process.
Yeah, so no, we didn't offer them to Erie County municipalities because we have the current capability to do that and work very closely with those municipalities. So the capability exists with our new updated facilities. This just gives some of the areas that don't receive in this particular case, these were purchased off of the Urban Area Security Initiative. They never had access to those counties. So it's a matter of the haves, which is Erie County in this particular case, and the have-nots, which are these other areas. Specifically with the trailer to Sardinia, there was a request that if we actually did have a surplus trailer, if you're not familiar with that particular area, there have been a series of bad accidents down there over the years. They put together a resource to be able to shut down Route 16 and other areas as a result of that being a fairly dangerous area. They just didn't have the trailer, nor do they have the capability of necessarily even purchasing a trailer on their own at this point with all of the other budgetary things that they need to balance. So they were the obvious fit for this particular trailer. And now when there's a major accident, they need to shut down the road. They have that capability.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there a motion to approve on the floor?
Motion to approve.
Okay. Second. Motion to approve by Legislator Todaro, seconded by Legislator Gilmore. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Commissioner Neverth. Okay, that concludes our actionable items. Now what we'll do, we'll go right into our discussion. So I would like to say good morning, everyone, and thank you all for being here. I'd like to thank the sheriff and the undersheriff for being here, appearing before this committee as the body anticipates gaining honest insight, clarification, and facts from a multitude of serious occurrences within the county's jail and road management. As you know, deputies' wrongdoings have surfaced. Most of these issues only came to public and our knowledge through media outlets filing full requests to obtain deputies and corrections officers' personnel files after the state's changes to the Section 58 law in 2020. Because we know about these issues, we wanted to understand how the Sheriff's Office and Professional Standards Unit investigates and handles complaints and allegations about deputies and corrections officers. I convened this discussion because over the past 6 months, we've seen a flurry of disclosures about sheriff's personnel being in trouble, accused of breaking laws, violating the sheriff's office code of conduct, having sexual relations with prisoners or former prisoners, a DUI incident in an unmarked take-home vehicle, a deputy consorting with felons, a deputy using police access to stalk a girlfriend and her friends, corrections officers getting out of his personal vehicle on a weekend day and threatening protesters with a baseball bat and others. So to ensure that, you know, we have a timely, time and efficient and productive meeting, you know, we went through our agenda items and I'll turn the floor over to the sheriff for introductions. Then we'll go into our line of questioning. Sheriff Howard, the floor is yours.
Just in your opening comment, none of these incidents that were brought to light by you or questioned by the legislature involved any staff members having sex with any individuals while they were inmates. There is some allegations of contact with inmates after their release. But I think just to make some general comments as to the different types of discipline that have been meted out at the conclusion of the investigations is historically we have looked to both the county attorney and to the labor department for an indication that should we administer a level of discipline that was then reversed by an arbitrator, that the payment of back wages, including overtime, would be reimbursed by either the labor department's budget or the county attorney's risk retention budget, both of which offers have been refused. So our ultimate administrating or placing of discipline, our disciplinary decisions, are based on the collective bargaining agreement and upon the arbitrator's past practices and decisions that have been either made on Erie County cases or in cases in other counties, which these arbitrators then follow in deciding whether or not our level of discipline is correct or not correct. So if you want to discuss individually the six questions in your letter, that's fine with me. I'll go ahead and do that. Or if you'd like to proceed differently.
Well, we do have questions, and we'll go right into the questions. So, and I thank you for that clarification. We do all understand that these are, you know, right now this is what the news has reported out to us, and you know, and we just want to go on what the news reported out to us. We have not had a report from you in any of these allegations, but this is what the news reported to us. So this is what we have to go on. So thank you for that clarification. So I'll start. With the first line of questioning before I turn it out to the floor, the Professional Standards Union, who does the investigation into these allegations, who is in charge of that Professional Standards Unit?
There are a number of different personnel assigned to it, but it's under the direct supervision of the undersheriff.
Okay. And those personnel, what are the backgrounds in that? So what are the backgrounds of those individuals that you just talked about?
Yeah, they come from various different parts of the Erie County Sheriff's Office. I know that may as well jump to it. The question has been raised that many of them do not hold rank. So they are, I guess, outranked by individuals that they sometimes investigate. And I'm very open and willing to consider making changes in that regard and certainly see a point to it. But in a paramilitary organization, that sometimes happens, that people that work under the direct supervision of an undersheriff or a higher ranking officer operate under that individual's authority and not under their own rank. So that's what's carried us thus far. But if there is a concern that they should be higher ranking, obviously higher ranking is also higher paid, but I have no objections to making changes in that regard.
Okay. And who was previously in charge of the professional standards before the undersheriff, the current undersheriff?
The former undersheriff, Mark Whipperman.
Okay. And how long did he operate in that capacity?
About 10 years. If you wanted to know exact answer, I could probably provide that. But it's always been, even back to the point that when I was the undersheriff, I had direct supervision of internal affairs professional standards.
Okay, so do you have an exact number of how many deputies serve in this unit?
Probably about five.
Okay, you said they're not ranking.
We have a sergeant there, and the daily command structure within the office. Sometimes the undersheriff goes in, works out of that specific office building, over 134 West Eagle. But there's usually a sergeant with those individuals in the office that supervises them on a daily basis.
Okay. Are they all represented by the Sheriff's PBA, or are they Teamsters, CSA?
They could come from different parts of the agency, and they are represented by the union that represents the work group that they come from.
Okay. And who actually investigates the wrongdoing in that group? Who actually investigates?
It depends on what the incident is. If it's a more serious matter, then the sergeant would be directly involved in it, or the undersheriff himself.
Okay. You know, what training and education are professional standards that group staff required to maintain? Specific
training for it. They have some specific training regarding the unique nature of their work and professional standards. They otherwise are trained to the level of the position that they're coming from. So the jailed personnel are trained in jail issues, in addition to certain unique circumstances regarding professional standards. Same true in the criminal division.
Okay, and can you get into the specifics of the training, the level of training, courses, classes, things of that nature?
Undersheriff Green, let me touch on that. So there are standards that are in place by usually DCJS, and they provide training on a yearly basis for individuals that are doing this type of work. So those trainings are all provided by DCJS.
Okay. All right. Next question.
It may be good to point out one unique thing is that to understand the conflict that in any internal affairs case, any conduct, any investigation involving misconduct by an employee, if there's a potential for a criminal prosecution, there are some very clear lines that the employer has an opportunity to compel a statement from an employee. But once a statement has been compelled, the district attorney's office, should there be a prosecution, has to prove that none of the information used in the criminal case is a result of anything that was gained from the compelled statement as protected by the Fifth Amendment. So there are some very clear difficulties or potential conflicts in doing an internal affairs investigation separate and different from a criminal investigation.
Okay, and how does a deputy get assigned to that professional standards unit?
We post a notice of an opening or a potential assignment to that unit. We look for individuals to volunteer. We then make a selection based on the individuals that volunteer, including their own employment history.
Okay. And how long are they assigned to the unit?
Sometimes they remain there and sometimes they're promoted. Our sergeant was recently promoted to lieutenant, and he left internal affairs as a result of his promotion. Should we get an opportunity to put higher ranking people there, he may well choose to return.
Okay. And all right, I got a few more questions, so just bear with me. So why is there no information online showing how, you know, members of the public or anyone can file a complaint to the Professional Standards Union? You know, like a web form or a web address. I know there's only a phone number out there.
I think we have some things online, but we've already had the discussion about making our complaints available online. So that certainly was a good suggestion, which we welcome. And we will ultimately get that when we have people available to make it available online. So it is a good idea. I should say that we accept complaints however they come in, some in writing, some anonymous. And many of our complaints, I would say the majority of our complaints, are actually generated by our own supervisors, which would not need that form. But we will make it available, a complaint form available as soon as we can online for the public.
So what's your timeline on making that form available?
I would think within a couple, I'm being told in the background here, within a couple of weeks.
So we can expect to see that in a couple of weeks. Okay.
In the meantime, anybody watching, you don't need a complaint form to make a complaint. We welcome complaints. You receive complaints by phone, by letters, but to make it available is certainly online is certainly a good idea, and we will do that.
So would it be safe to assume that most of your complaints come via letter?
No, I think most of our complaints come from our own supervisors, but the complaints that come from the public come by letters or email. However, if anyone wants to make a complaint, some are addressed to me, some are addressed to the undersheriff, some are just generally addressed, but they all go to professional standards.
All right. And so when they come via email, where did they go? Because you just said email, and I know I just asked that you said that you didn't have an email address. And I'm not trying to interrogate, but I just want to have a better understanding. So you said email. So, what email, who are they emailing? I guess that's the question.
I think that emails for all county employees are a combination of their first and last names, followed by Erie dot org, by gov, dot gov. But again, I don't know if I can break it down statistically. I sometimes have emails sent to me. Sometimes they're sent to the undersheriff. Sometimes they're sent to the various commanders, chiefs within the sheriff's office, but all complaints go to professional standards.
Okay. So when you get them, when they come to you, you forward them on to professional standards?
Actually, I would forward them to the undersheriff, and he forwards them or delivers them or assigns them to professional standards.
So how would anyone from the public know who to contact? I guess that's my next question.
It doesn't matter who they contact. They go to unaddressed, it comes to the sheriff's office. Any complaint that comes to the sheriff's office is sent to professional standards. It doesn't matter who it's addressed to.
Okay.
So we recognize it as a complaint. or we become aware of it, even if it doesn't come in, even if it comes in as a statement of fact, or if it comes in as a lawsuit, it's referred to professional standards. We read about it in a newspaper and we recognize that it's a potential complaint. It's referred to professional standards. So any way that we become aware of alleged misconduct or potential misconduct by any member of our staff, it's referred to professional standards.
Okay. What statistics can you provide about the number of complaints filed and the nature of the complaints? For instance, in 2019, how many complaints were filed? How many were investigated? How many deputies were investigated? What was the nature and types of those complaints filed?
Under Sheriff Greenan is looking at his notes now to see if we have any information on that. Yes.
So I think one of the best ways to address that question is really to address it by looking at what an outsider did as an analysis of our complaints, because that outsider's analysis is therefore an outsider's analysis and not us analyzing it in such a way that it spins it in the best possible direction. As many of you probably know, and I believe this was provided to you, one of the local media stations, Channel 4, back in November, Dan Tevlock and Luke Moretti did an in-depth investigation into all of our complaints to the Professional Standards Division in for the years of 2018 and 2019. During that period, there were 291 disciplinary records, complaints that were made, and that could have been anything from a complaint of excessive force to the fact that we investigate every car accident that one of our deputies is in. So if a deer runs into one of our cars, that generates a professional standards review just to make sure that that deputies were appropriately driving their vehicles at the time of those accidents. So for those 2 years, there was 291 disciplinary actions. 98 of those complaints involved vehicle accidents. Six of those were allegations of sexual harassment. 13 were allegations of sexual assault. And 9 of those were complaints of excessive force. I think it's very important to note that when Channel 4 did their investigation, they actually hired an outside expert who was an expert in use of force and complaints, a nationwide expert to analyze these results, and ultimately what he found, he was stunned in what he had found, and found that we had actually, as far as serious punishment for deputies who did something wrong, he found that we were 400% higher in doling out serious punishment to our deputies than other counties across the country. He was incredibly surprised that that 1 in 3 of the complaints that we received, some form of discipline occurred. Again, that's 1 in 3 with a 400% better rating than counties, other counties and other law enforcement agencies across the United States. So sometimes in the politics of all of this, this gets lost in the politics of the media. It gets lost what an independent evaluator who is an expert in these matters actually found, that we are much, much better than most police agencies in our disciplinary process.
I have a ton more questions, but what I want to do is turn it over to the floor and get, I know my colleagues have questions.
Before you move on, can I just take that a little bit further? Maybe it backs it up a little bit. The question I think that you initially posed and the undersheriff answered, the outside or independent individual said it was about 300 a year. We don't know if that includes other investigations that are done by our staff. I suspect that it does not. But among our staff and professional standards, maybe some of the cases that aren't counted includes routine sick leave checks that employees that are calling off sick. We have a staff member that when not busy with other things is is looking to see that, in fact, that individual is at home or, in fact, is sick and is not misusing his or her sick leave. I'd like to acknowledge something else. We do not or have not historically publicized or printed the number of complaints and the breakdown that the undersheriff just did, but I certainly recognize that as being a good idea, and we hope to also be doing that soon, in which we are publicizing our statistics on the total number of complaints that are handled and what they were about and the outcome of them.
Okay, thank you. So as I said, we have questions on the floor. Legislator Meyer, I see your hands. I didn't want to go to Legislator Myers first, then Legislator Bask. Legislator Myers, floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sheriff, good to see you. Long time no see. First of all, I want to thank you for being here today. Appreciate your time. I just have a question, quick question. I'll yield my time here. I know that you had spoke about when we talk about discipline, contractual agreements and how they play into discipline and things of that nature. I was just wondering, there was an example of a sworn personnel of the Sheriff's Department. He was prosecuted by the DA for a crime and kept his job. And then he pled guilty to like insurance fraud and then kept his job. And then after that, he was found guilty of falsifying timesheets. He or she, I don't even know, was found guilty of falsifying timesheets. So is there something to that, that if you could just speak to that about how that works with the discipline, I was just wondering how someone could plead guilty to this, keep their job, and then be brought up again on something else months later.
I think to make just some generalities, I guess it would be the right word. Not every crime would justifiably lead to a termination. And we know that from past practices, from reviewing arbitrators' decisions. And I think maybe that the case that you're referring to may be the one I'm thinking of, but in fact, that the employee was brought back on a last chance agreement. Those last chance agreements by the rules or the arbitrator's decisions have to have, they can't be forever. They have to have a shelf life or a completion date. But the next act of misconduct by that individual, in fact, occurred within, I think, a day or two of the expiration of that. And I think it's just by chance. So it was our prediction that had that case led to a termination, that somewhere down the road, and I think you've got other cases there, legislator, in your own hometown to refer to, recently publicized, that the arbitrators routinely or frequently give civil service, not just police, but civil service employees their jobs back, and too often as well award both back pay as well as overtime that was never worked. So it's our concern in doing this, both to not engage in the wrongful retention of employees, but not to fire employees or suspend them for a long period of time, only to have an arbitrator give them back pay and overtime while we've often paid overtime to someone else to do the work of that suspended or terminated employee, only to pay them back with taxpayer dollars. Again, if we move toward maybe how this might be prevented or where we might be more willing to administer stiffer penalties if it comes out of risk retention or out of the Department of Labor's budget, I'd be much more willing to do that than to see it coming out of my own budget, only to have to explain my overtime and exceeding my budget to pay employees that were suspended and of no value during their suspension to the taxpayers that are paying them.
So I guess, is it fair to say then that when you come to discipline, part of the decision-making process is how you feel how an arbitrator may rule on it, whether you want to push the envelope on that employee or not?
I'd say that's pretty much exactly what it is. We look at our case like the district attorney would look at a criminal case and say, how likely are we to win this case in arbitration, what penalty might be negotiated with the union representing that individual, that it would be acceptable to them, to the employee, and to the taxpayers. So yeah, it's not just my anger or my disappointment in an employee that's engaged in misconduct. It's what will the courts or the arbitrators ultimately accept. So do you need more?
Yeah. Can I, Legislator Myers, if I could just touch on that a little bit, because this is something that I've dealt with not only in my role as undersheriff, but in my 12 years as commissioner of personnel for the county. What often happens, what's happened one too many times, is an employee has been terminated for an offense. It's a year and a half before you go through the arbitration process, and arbitrators very regularly then rule that, well, the employee was improperly terminated. You have to hire them back with back pay. You have to hire them back with what they normally would have made in overtime. We have to make them whole. In the meantime, while they're out for that year and a half, we're backfilling and paying somebody time and a half to cover that person's that person's work. Now, you may say, well, that sounds crazy. But again, using your own hometown of Cheektowaga, and I've got a Buffalo News article here in my hand from by Matt Spina from
Excuse me. Can we just keep it here to the sheriff's office?
I'm keeping it to.
I know, but Cheektowaga is investigating Cheektowaga. We want to keep here right to the office of the sheriff. I get what you're saying.
This has to do directly with the office of the sheriff, and that is where you had because this is how I'm going to the point of how arbitrators deal with us. Is you've got an instance where a deputy or a police officer in Cheektowaga punched his supervisor, was fired for it, and was subsequently forced to be rehired with back pay by an arbitrator. So that's just a very recent example of what we in the sheriff's office have to deal with. And I only use it as an example because it was very recently in the media.
Probably a good time to note that we were actually criticized in the media because we terminated an employee who was involved in an alleged theft by another theft from another government employee from a different agency in government. And that specific individual was returned to duty by the arbitrator with back pay and overtime. So the arbitrator's decisions from other levels of government, not just law enforcement, spill over to all civil service employees. So at times the discipline that we administer to a sworn employee is compared to that of a non-sworn employee elsewhere within the civil service system. So it would do very well for anybody that's concerned about law enforcement across the country to be looking at the disciplinary systems that have been approved by government and not by police executives, but yet the police executives are bound by those labor agreements, which are in Erie County's case, Erie County is the dual employer to the sheriff's employees as well.
If I could, just one last follow-up. From both of my other jobs, whether it be the township of Chicago or the airport, I've been involved in a lot of arbitrations. I just wonder, has there ever been a point, Sheriff, where, you know, you thought that maybe, you know, an arbitration could go either way, or maybe counsel, somebody said, yeah, you might not win it, this or that, but you personally yourself felt that, you know what, this is too egregious. I'm going to fire this guy and let's roll the dice and let's see what happens here, just out of interest of justice.
In fact, just before I became the sheriff, I was involved in exactly that, in which we terminated I guess I won't mention it by name, but in which we terminated an employee, and we probably spent I'm 6 months in court and we refused to back off. I'm on the county's position there. And in the end, we were successful and the arbitrator upheld that decision. And it thereafter has gone beyond the arbitrators and went into actually into the civil courts, and our decision was upheld. But where we know that we're not likely to be upheld, then we're more apt to make a more lenient disciplinary decision in negotiation with the union. And again, it's to save taxpayers' resources.
Again, and just, I know I'm taking a lot of time. I'll be brief here, because it's just to my point that, I mean, nobody has a crystal ball. Nobody knows how any arbitrator is going to rule. You know, you may think you have a slam dunk, then it goes the other way. But I just think that at some point, it may be up in the air, this or that. I just think it kind of sends a message to any wrongdoers that, you know, if you do something wrong here in Erie County, you're going to be held accountable and we're going to come after you.
Well, I agree with that exactly, except to say where an arbitrator has had a similar case to the one that we are handling, arbitrators look to the other arbitrators' decisions for past practice. And where we would violate a past practice, knowing that we're going to lose the case, knowing that we are sending a harsh message, that ultimately the union then steps in and under their duty of fair representation, represents that individual. We spend years and months in court, only to see that employee get back all of that back pay, sends just the opposite message. It shows that the management is not concerned for the taxpayers or for retaining an employee that still holds a value in whom we've made an investment. It sends just the opposite message. It makes the union a hero and the administration the goat.
Thank you, Sheriff. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your time. I appreciate it.
Okay. Chair Baskin, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just flag me if I go out at any time. My computer has been giving me some trouble. Just give me a hand signal and I'll try to work out my sound. I just want to say, under Sheriff Green, and I think it's absolutely unbecoming of you to use this time to take cheap political shots when we are gathered here today in this committee to really try to make sure that we get to the bottom of the well-being and the human rights of residents that are housed in the facility that you have oversight of. We don't have to go into it. You know what you said. I know what you said. Other people that are here today know what you're saying and what you're trying to say. And I think that we should keep on task and try to improve what we can improve over at the office of the sheriff. Mr. Chairperson, I know that you said you want to take this in special segments and you don't want us like jumping around to deputies who have like been seen swinging baseball bats and deputies who then questions over here about deputies caught sleeping on the job. You want to take it through a very specific timeline so that we have a cohesive conversation and we can get questions out about each of those incidences. So I want to go back to how you opened up, which was with professional standards. First and foremost, I have a concern with the way that we just kind of opened up the committee and just kind of glazed past sexual assault allegations involving corrections officers and detainees. I think we do have to spend some time talking about that in detail. I do not think that I agree with the sheriff that it has never happened. I don't think we've gotten to the bottom of any case thus far. So it's too soon to say if it has happened or if it hasn't. We do know that last November, it came out that the sheriff's office failed to report 5 alleged sexual crimes involving jail guards and inmates to the Commission on Corrections, which is required by law. Superintendent Dina did tell the news, "We have conducted an audit of prior investigations dating back to 2018 and found."
You went out. You went out. You went out.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Now, whether those errors, I said the part about jail superintendent Dina telling the news that they have conducted an audit of prior investigations dating back to 2018 and found that 5 found. out there. I don't. I'll move if I go out again. I'll just move out into where my aide is. I don't know if those were related to sexual alleged crimes or not, but it was around the time in which those allegations were made. And to that point, later, there is, in fact, a sergeant, I don't want to say his name or anything, a Teamster sergeant who actually married a person, a prisoner that he met while she was in the holding center. Later, two other inmates said that this particular sergeant made sexual advances towards them as he monitored them while they did inmate cleaning. Later, I know last September, those cases were found unfounded because of lack of evidence. But I think the greater point here is if the sheriff's office has a history of failing to report to the COC, we don't really know if there could have been evidence to find this sergeant or any other officer who has been alleged to make sexual advances to prisoners, true or not. So we can't just say that it's never happened if we've never had a thorough investigation of it, or if the sheriff's office has a history of not reporting things that would complicate a fair investigation. Superior versus subordinate relationships are something that has to be taken very seriously when it comes to sexual assault allegations, especially in the case of law enforcement and an officer versus a prisoner. So that's something that we shouldn't just brush by. We have to spend time talking about it. If it's happening, it has to stop. Back to professional standards. Thank you, Chair Johnson, for all the questions that you asked, but I'm still just not clear on how the professional standards division is actually set up. Is this something that is required by the COC for each local jail facility to impanel themselves? How do we choose who sits on the professional standards committee? How often are they transferred out? Like, I get that Under Sheriff Greenan is the person that's in charge of it, but who appoints these people that sit on the professional standards committee? And are they people that have to be approved by just you and your policy, Sheriff Howard, that you set within the jail, or are they are they structured under some type of system that is identified and outlined for professional standards from the state?
I guess we'll go back to your first comment. I never said that I was not willing to discuss any of the 6 points in Legislator Johnson's letter. I asked Legislator Johnson if he wanted me to jump into those and answer them in the order that they were asked in his letter, or if he wanted to come back to him, and he chose to move this in a different direction first.
For a point of clarity, Mr. Chair, may I have the floor? For a point of clarity, I didn't say that the sheriff did not want to talk about it. I just was a little bothered at how we brushed by it and how he said that has not happened. He said, when we opened up this committee, that sexual relations between an officer at the holding center and inmates had not happened. And I just want to say that we don't know that to be true. And that's not something that we should say on the record if we don't know it to be true or not. That's all. Moving on to my question. Professional standards, the people who sit on the professional standards division, are they appointed and supervised solely by you, Mr. Sheriff, or is that something that is structured by the state?
The structuring of the internal affairs unit is a matter of approval by various committees of the state. The accreditation standards for both the jail as well as police services that evaluates an agency's internal affairs operations. So the structuring is somewhat a matter of decision by the head of the agency. So in that regard, I have approved the structuring of our internal affairs unit. The supervision of the unit is by the undersheriff on a daily basis, using a middle manager, in the current case being a sergeant that answers directly to the undersheriff.
So you set the policies and the procedures, you appoint the people who serve in the division, and then they serve under the supervision of the undersheriff.
Whom I also appoint, yes.
Who you also appoint. And then there's another sergeant that they also have to report to under the undersheriff?
Yes.
Okay. So really there are three people in charge of impaneling professional standards. Structure it, and then the oversight is by the undersheriff and this assistant sergeant.
Yes.
How many people currently sit on the in the professional standards division right now?
Six. We initially said five, but we've since found out it's six.
Okay. Is that including the undersheriff and the sergeant?
It includes the sergeant, not the undersheriff.
Okay. And then how long, according to your policy, are they supposed to be in place, and how often is their professional standards audited for them to even be qualified to serve in a way in which they're evaluating the professional standards of their colleagues?
I think some of them retire from that position. Many of them are promoted from their role in professional standards, promoted off of civil service lists to higher positions. Some of them may just elect after a period of time and ask to leave. I don't recall ever moving one out by my decision. They leave based on their own desire to go elsewhere.
Okay, so in the matter of making judgments against the professional behaviors of those that are employed in your office, that division could have people that are there for 15, 20 years themselves.
That could be possible, yes.
Are they civil service or managerial
All of the staff assigned to professional standards are civil service employees. With the exception of the undersheriff, who is not necessarily civil service.
Could you say it one more time?
That all of the employees, with the exception of the undersheriff, at the current time, all of the employees and professional standards are civil service employees.
All six. Okay, and you said you can get to us how long each of them have been in place?
What was the question?
You will be able to provide us with information about how long each person that serves in the division has been there.
Sure.
Thank you. And how often, Mr. Sheriff, do you go in and review their professional standards?
That's done by the undersheriff. So I do not do that.
How often does he do it?
Every day. He's a telephone conversation every day. Do you go there every day? He probably is. There are two or three days a week that he's actually spends time in that office.
I'll wrap up, Mr. Chair, and I'll just circle back with other questions when you move on to other topics shortly, because I don't want to take up the floor. But what qualifications do you have, Mr. Sheriff, officers to even serve in this division in the first place?
If you're asking my qualifications, I was a ranking officer.
No, sir. I'm sorry. I'll rephrase. What qualifications do you require of those who you appoint to this division? They're charged with having to look at situations that involve a deputy, a sheriff, them upholding their oath of office. I would assume that they have to have some type of qualifications to be able to, you know, be deemed honest, transparent, thorough people who don't have an issue with holding their colleagues accountable.
That answer would start with their initial hiring by the office. And you think you'd see this true that we refer to it as a selection process, but in fact, it may be better referred to as a rejection process, that we do background investigations on all of our staff. There is no real indicator of a good moral background. It's the absence of anything to indicate that they are of poor moral background or poor moral character. When it comes then to the assignment from choosing from individuals who have already passed a background, we look at their own internal affairs records, and an absence of any indication of them being engaged in misconduct, including to their own attendance rate, because that's a huge part of what it's done by our internal affairs, is to inquire about the attendance rates of other employees.
Does that differ, Mr. Sheriff, from appointing deputies to other divisions in the jail?
We're not talking just the jail. We're talking the entire sheriff's office. But maybe for a point of clarification, when there's an allegation of criminal conduct on the part of a staff, that is not done by internal affairs. That's done by our own criminal division and our own detectives that are differently trained to investigate criminal matters. And it is a separate, somewhat parallel investigation to the internal affairs part of that. But there's a very clear line between the two, but criminal investigations, including an allegation of sexual assaults, is handled by our criminal division, very much under the guidelines of New York State, and the separate internal affairs investigation involving a potential administrative violation is handled by the internal affairs.
I see. I think what would help, because I was not aware of that, I think what would help would be the written policies that help us know when, because I remember when the incident happened with the deputy who had a baseball bat and it was swung at protesters last summer. And I asked about it, and I was told by Superintendent Dina that it was being reviewed by professional standards. So I guess because the criminal division is something that is very much structured by the state, but it seems like the professional standards division is something that is more in-house and just directly policy and a structure that you set up. Stop me if I'm misunderstanding anything. What would help me would be to understand when something is deemed, what is the policy to identify when something has to go to the criminal division versus your internal affairs professional standards division, and then what policies and requirements you have to for the people that actually serve in your professional standards division. That's going to be super, super important to understand, and how it differs from the criminal division. If we could get that sent to us via email so that we could look at it, then we will be at a place where we can start to dive into maybe you embracing, like you said at the beginning, some types of reform so that we can do better. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have to object at this point that you dust upon or open a door to investigations and not take an opportunity to clarify exactly what it is you're saying. The allegations of our staff having contact with inmates is completely separate than an allegation of our staff having sexual relations with an inmate while they are an inmate. I'm not sure if you're suggesting that you don't like it that we have a standard that prohibits our staff from having any type of relationship with a former inmate, if you're making any judgment on whether that's right or that's wrong, or it's wrong for law enforcement, but okay for other people, or that after an individual is an inmate and has been released back to society, I think other comments I've heard from you suggest that individual is now whole and is just like every other member of society, except that they can't have a relationship with our staff. But making it very clear that the cases that you referred to was not a suggestion that those other staff employees were having sexual relations with inmates while they were inmates. I think the other case that you referred to, and you said that the Superintendent Dina had indicated that it was under investigation. In fact, was done as an investigation. Both it happened in a jurisdiction and where sheriff's criminal deputies were not the primary responders. So the criminal part of that investigation was handled by a different agency without an arrest. But an investigation was done by our internal affairs people. Discipline was administered, and it is currently a matter of a union grievance, and for that reason is not subject to public discussion while it remains a subject of a union grievance and pending arbitration. I think you'd see that backed up by county labor that says the same thing.
I think, if I may, Mr. Chair, just respond. I think, Mr. Sheriff, it is just all very unclear. And because it involves the issue of sexual contact, be it with someone, be it an allegation made by an inmate, be it a case that is of sexual assault that has been found to be true or untrue, be it a deputy who later had sexual contact or married someone who was formerly a subordinate and a prisoner, it is all unclear. It is all meshing together. And I think why we are here today is to be able to have an understanding of what the policies are, what the procedures are, what the expectations are, so that we can separate them, understand them, and be able to communicate a clear narrative to the community, and most importantly, protect anybody that may be in harm's way with an inappropriate or unprofessional jail deputy. That's all. Thank you, Mr.
I share in that goal. I should make it perfectly clear once again that all criminal investigations or all allegations of criminal conduct are investigated by the police agency that has jurisdiction in that area. So if we receive a complaint in the city of Buffalo, we would make a referral to the Buffalo Police for the criminal investigation. It would be investigated according to the state standards for any such investigation. It also should be clear that the district attorney's office has the authority of looking at any case and making a grand jury presentation if there's a suspicion or a belief on the part of the district attorney's office that criminal conduct has in fact occurred. If it is an administrative violation, which is a much lower standard of proof than a criminal investigation, those are handled by internal affairs. So I can't make it any clearer that criminal investigations are conducted by people that do criminal investigations, are reported to the state according to that. Administrative investigations, they're handled differently. And again, in occasion, there is a separate obligation on the part of, in this case, the jail to report certain levels of conduct. To go back to something you said, that was a failure on the part of some jail staff to not properly report it to the Commission of Corrections. Has nothing at all to do with its level of investigation by both the criminal division and the professional standards division. It was a failure to share that information with the Commission of Corrections.
If we could just get your set expectations for your internal affairs division, your professional standards division, then we will be able to better understand what transparency mechanism and accountability mechanism is set by your office for when you have situations with deputies like those that came into the press over the last year. So you've already said you'll provide that to us, and we'll look at it and probably have a follow-up committee discussion about it. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I know, Legislator Vine, you have your hand up. I just have a clarifying question, then we can go right into Gene, Legislator Vinyl's question. So those on the professional standards that serve on the professional standards, Sheriff Howard, have any of those officers who serve on professional standards had any allegations against them or, you know, or been a part of any investigation against themselves?
I am not aware of any against them.